right, everyone. It is Tuesday, February 4th. You're tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Kind of mild out there, but it's a dark winter in Iowa. I covered the caucus in part, or I was part of a team for Pacifica out of Ames, Iowa last night. At 7:30, I was so perky. I was so upbeat. Yeah. I was so go team fight. At about 12:15, when they called me for the second time right after John Nichols spoke, I was beyond morose. I just have to tell you. And I shared with Ken this morning my favorite tweet of the day, everyone, came in last night at probably around 10:30 or 11 o'clock, and I posted it because I just thought it was sheer genius. Here is the tweet by Matt Carolian. Have we tried turning Iowa off and back on again? What genius! What genius! And in a lot of ways, my heart breaks for them. My heart breaks for them. But oh God, Ken, so many people spent so many thousands of hours, millions of dollars. They were so engaged. They showed up. There are flaws with the Iowa caucus as a caucus itself. But to compound this on top of everything else, but there's one really disappointing thing, and I'm going to mention this to John Nichols as well because I can't repeat it enough. The turnout sucked.
Mm.
They said it was going to be the largest turnout ever, and everybody, and that to me is the story. It's not that we don't have the numbers; it's that we didn't get the turnout.
Mm.
With Donald Trump out there, how could everyone that didn't have a pulse? I would offer babysitting for nothing. I don't know what to do.
I think some of them did.
I think they did. And yet the turnout was the equivalent of 2016, and it didn't meet the high threshold of 2008 with Barack Obama. And I hate to say this, but as exciting as it is to have Barack Obama running for president, it's more terrifying to know that Donald Trump is our president.
Yeah. That's true.
Anyway.
Well, I feel bad for the people of Iowa because they're the ones, and the American people and the candidates are all harmed by a glitch. I can't even say for sure
that it's
human error by the people that ran it. It could be just machine error. But maybe this will go to show everybody that, hey, look, we're all human. We mess up even in the high stakes circumstances. And maybe the country doesn't have to hate each other. Maybe we can actually forgive each other a little bit and say, well, let's try to work things out to be a little better.
Well, it in a way, Iowa and the caucus reminds me of town meeting. And the reason is at town meeting, you have to show up at a specific time. And you can't get an absentee ballot at a town meeting. You have to physically be there.
Yeah.
And only certain people can then show up. And too many town meetings now are less and less attended because people can't find the time or they don't choose to give the time. And while in the beginning it made sense in 1777, it may not make sense in 2020. And yet there's a virtue to town meeting that you get to see each other, that you get to touch your neighbor, that you get to connect about the dump and you get to talk about the roads. And what we are losing in that human contact that you see in a caucus and you see in a town meeting, also now in this age of technology and chaotic lives. I mean, we have three jobs, and we don't have grandparents living across the street that can watch the kids. So it's another example of what the problems are. And I don't know how to thread it together, but I kind of do. And I believe in universal service. Now more than ever, I want to throw everyone into an obligation of citizenship. And that obligation is you get to know your neighbors in Alabama. You spend 2 years doing something, whether it's in the military or whether it's working in some field in South Dakota. But that way we create that human relationship, we create that contact, and we begin to Velcro our country together. And I think that is one of the best antidotes because social media sucks.
Yeah. I think actually, you were talking about the turnout earlier, and I wonder if that isn't the best job for an investigative reporter now is to go back to Iowa
and find out
not
why.
Figure out why they couldn't report it, but figure out why people didn't turn out when these candidates have invested how many hours of their lives
out there. And all the polling said it was going to be the biggest turnout ever. They were thinking thousands more than before, and it didn't even reach that.
Right. They talked to everybody that lives in Iowa, why aren't people turning out would be a good lesson for all of us. But
it wasn't the weather.
And
usually the weather has, becomes an impediment. The weather was perfect for the caucus.
Yeah. One other thing you talked about at 7 o'clock, everybody was chipper and looking forward to it. And at midnight, everybody was like, oh, give me a break. Get me out of here. But in between, I actually found it pretty interesting to watch the folks in the caucus when they were doing yes. their thing. Kind of dragged. It's not exactly a fast-paced action movie, but it
like
was...
Like watching cricket, you mean?
Yeah. yeah. But it was interesting to see how people gathered and then moved and then tried. I think it was Des Moines where there was one independent group that mm-hmm. didn't make the cutoff and right. they were begging the Pete Buttigieg right. people to come right. down and right. put them over 15%. And then they interviewed two women in a different location. I can't remember where. And one of them was for, I don't know, Klobuchar, and one of them was for somebody else. It was Buttigieg maybe, or Warren. And this is my friend, my next door neighbor, well, you know.
Disagree.
We disagree, but at the end of the day, my candidate didn't make the 15% threshold. So, yeah, when I'm deciding where to go, I'll come to my friend's place.
Well, you know.
That was kind of interesting.
I just did WGBH this morning on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. And one of the things I didn't get to say, but someone did say it, and they cut me off after only 10 minutes. I can't understand why. But anyway, what I also like about the caucus, and this guy actually commented on it, which was where I was going to go next, mm-hmm. was that it was a little bit like ranked choice voting.
Yeah.
So what exactly. you get is if you don't get your first choice, what's your second choice? If you don't get your second choice, what's your third choice? And so I like the idea of ranked mm-hmm. choice voting. I think in a lot of ways it really it is a way of bringing people together so that, you know, if everyone yeah. doesn't get their first choice, hallelujah. Maybe the second choice is the compromise candidate that will actually hold us together. So there's a value to ranked choice voting. And in a lot of ways you mm. saw a visual example of that with
yeah.
the caucus.
And this added a living element to the ranked choice voting. Ranked choice voting, you fill out your first, second, third
right,
choice
right.
at ab initio at right. the beginning. And here, okay, my candidate isn't in it, so who do I like right. of the rest? Let's
right.
talk about it.
And you get to see how people are processing, and there's something beautiful about that process.
There is.
We got to grab John Nichols.
Yes.
So John Nichols writes for The Nation magazine. I heard John Nichols last night on Pacifica. He actually showed up just before I did. And he'll be joining us to talk a little bit about what he saw, because remember, he was on the ground. He was with the Bernie folks, no surprise. And I'm kind of curious as to what he thought. But it was – so I've been seeing tweets coming out from places like SheSource. SheSource sort of lets people know around the world about sort of who in the media you should talk to from a female perspective. And I am now the hot commodity. SheSource just tweeted me out saying, if you want to know about the New Hampshire primary, the go-to person is Arnie Arneson. So thank you, SheSource. I'm not sure I want any more phone calls. That's all I have to say. You know what this feels like to me? So the Guardian newspaper – back in 2008, followed me around with a camera crew. And I was covering the New Hampshire primary, and Marty was still alive. And the reason I love telling this story is that it was a snowy night and it was cold, and I was covering the New Hampshire primary for an Australian television station. I mean, talk about, you know, coming out of nowhere. And they're following me. And we had heard that Barack Obama had just won Iowa. The prediction was Barack Obama was going to beat Hillary Clinton here by I can't even tell you how many points. And as I'm about to go and cover this, the numbers come out and Hillary Clinton defeats Barack Obama. And it made no sense. The polling had told us the opposite. We assumed that he was on the rise. We looked at what happened in Iowa. We said, oh, my God, there's no question that Barack Obama will deliver in New Hampshire. And then it turns out to be Hillary. And so you see the Guardian following me around with this camera crew as I'm racing out in the snow to a tent outside to do this uplink to Australian television. And I'm looking at the camera crew from the Guardian newspaper and I go, how the hell do I explain to Australia what happened with Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton when I can't explain it to myself? It is one of the funniest videos because I'm being so bloody honest. But to a large extent, John Nichols, who's joining us from The Nation magazine, the insanity from going from Iowa to New Hampshire in 2008 is now far eclipsed by what happened in Iowa last night, John Nichols. You were on Pacifica just before I was on Pacifica late last night, and I was listening to you and thinking, God, it's 12 hours later. We still don't have results. And the chaos of the Iowa caucus, I feel like, feels like the chaos of the country. We don't have direction. We're not getting things right. We don't know what to trust. It's an interesting kettle of fish. Welcome to the program, John Nichols of The Nation.
Thank you, Annie. I'm glad to have lived to see the greatest day in Bill Gardner's life.
Yeah, you're so funny. You're right.
That's an inside joke.
I know, yeah, I know.
Bill Gardner, Secretary of State of New Hampshire, fierce defender of New Hampshire's first in the nation primary status. I think it's always frustrated him that Iowa was out there. And my sense is Iowa may not be out there for too much longer.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's I was telling people I did WGBH, and Jim Browdy of GBH on Boston Public Radio has been trashing Iowa and New Hampshire for years, and he's in his incredible glory. He said, I just have to take the swear words out, but otherwise you can hear the rest of what I have to think. And it was so the disappointment for folks in Iowa must be overwhelming. But here's the question I need to pose to you since you were on the ground in Iowa. So we were told up until the night of the caucus that this was going to be the biggest turnout ever. We were going to see this huge influx of people. They were making sure they had enough space and chairs. We were looking at, you know, the greatest youth turnout, yada, yada, yada. And I hear last night that it basically compared to 2016, it didn't come close to what happened in 2008. Do you have any idea on a beautiful night in Iowa, so there's no weather issue, where young people are supposed to be so engaged and 17-year-olds could participate? We have Donald Trump as president. The greatest fear is that he could be returned in 2020. What the hell happened with the voters?
Well, this is an interesting thing, honey, because I think one of the mistakes we made to think that a bump in turnout will be across the board. And so you look at a circumstance, you say, well, the number last term was 240,000 or whatever. Yeah. So to have a bump, it's got to be 250 this time. This is a fascinating thing that happened in Iowa. There was a huge bump in turnout, a massive increase among people under 30.
Okay, I heard that too.
There was a significant decrease among people over 65.
Wow.
And so I've covered Iowa caucuses for a very, very long time. And the one thing I've always known about Iowa caucuses, even the good year like Obama, 08, it's skew old. You know, you go into these rooms and, you know, it just has an older feel. Mm-hmm. I was in a caucus in Dubuque last night, which is a working class, traditional union town, a town that Manchester might well understand. Mm-hmm. I was there to do some media about an hour before the caucus, and as people started coming in, I was like, oh, that's interesting. There's, you know, four young people. Oh, well, that's interesting. There's 10 young people coming. Wow. Well, that's interesting. Here comes another five young people. And by the time the caucus started, one entire side of the room, the Sanders side, was stunning. It was like, I went down a row, I asked people one after another, how old are you? 18, 19, 20, 18, 18, wow. 17. Mm-hmm. You know, it was so young. And then, like over in the Biden corner, they just, you know, they weren't there. The people didn't show. Biden barely met viability in Dubuque, yeah. A town where traditionally you would have thought he'd be a front runner. Yang brought out a ton of young people.
Yeah, I knew that would happen.
Had a substantial number of young folks, especially a lot of young women. Mm-hmm. And so the dynamic was, and I saw this, you can see this in the entry polls too, dramatic boost in the percentage of voters that are under 30, significant drop in over 65. Mm-hmm. Now, here's what I'm going to tell you. This is a warning for the Democratic Party. It is clear that Bernie Sanders, especially, is able to mobilize and get out a lot of young people. They'll sit for 3 hours to make it happen for them. None of these candidates have the same kind of drawing power for older voters.
Right. And that's not good either.
That's a big deal.
Yeah, that's not good.
You got to have both.
Well, you know, I think I heard this. I don't know what the numbers were. Maybe you can find it out because I wasn't, you know, I finally fell asleep. My understanding was that the percentage of young people that participated before had been about 18%, and what we saw last night was around 24%. And that's a significant rise. We knew that 17-year-olds were able to participate. And I've said this over and over again, John. I think young people are now owning a sense of responsibility that they can't depend on us and they have to depend on themselves. And I'm going to use the example of Parkland. I'm going to use the example of Greta. I will use the example of the 24% last night in the Iowa caucus. And that is, but the problem is that we have to connect that enthusiasm and that newness and that engagement and still make sure that we have candidates that can talk to people over the age of 55 or 65. And what that proved last night is what we knew about Joe Biden. Joe Biden does not excite people. There was no passion for Joe Biden. I've described Joe Biden as a slipper. He's a comfortable slipper. You like your slipper. You're familiar with your slipper. But your slipper can't climb Mount Everest. And frankly, Donald Trump is the Mount Everest of politics in 2020. And he just doesn't have the ability to sort of even get 55 and 65-year-olds excited about his capacity to win.
I think there's truth in that. And look, I'll also point out that Pete Buttigieg did do well. I don't think he won like he claimed victory, but he did do well in Iowa. And he drew at least in the places where I was, he drew the more traditional young caucus goers, i.e. people in their 30s and 40s. Mm-hmm. Right? That used to be young at a caucus.
Uh-huh.
And so Buttigieg had a lot of those folks. But there's clearly a challenge here. And the challenge was multifold. I also think that we may have seen, and people have talked about it from this perspective, I think we may have seen the point at which caucuses have outlasted their usefulness.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is separate and apart from all the technological glitches and all the problems. A caucus demands people come and spend a substantial amount of time in, you know, a location, you know, 2 hours maybe, talk with other folks doing politics. I think a lot of these young people found it exciting and engaging and fresh and new. I do not think it's necessarily works anymore to draw, you know, a real cross section. And remember, only about, you know, 10-12%, maybe a little higher, of Iowa Democrats participate in their caucuses. It's so dramatically lower than the percentage that participates in, say, a New Hampshire primary.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the combination of some of these turnout issues we're discussing and the complete meltdown of the tabulation process suggests that it's time. It's time to put it in.
All right, so Ken wants to weigh in.
Well, I was just going to ask you a question, John. I found it very interesting. You talked about what kind of voters under 30 that Sanders drew, and Buttigieg is in the 30 to 40 year old crowd. So, what about Elizabeth Warren's draw? Who did she?
That's a good question. Younger. Her draw was younger, at least at the caucus I was in. And this was, you know, an area. It'd be young, you know, kind of young family in college kind of area. But her group was young. It was overwhelmingly women, and they were. It's a very interesting thing with Elizabeth Warren. They were enthusiastic, good spirited. They came early with music and you know, snacks and the whole bit. They were very, very well prepared. And the interesting thing is that they started the night in the caucus I was in, looking like they might not even get viability, and they ended up getting, you know, more than enough. In fact, they ended up getting two precinct delegates, which is pretty good. So they did a good job.
Right.
Biden was a fascinating thing, just to point out in this context. Biden had an organizer, a real, you know, like a staffer on the ground there. Most of the people doing these things are volunteers. And that guy, I mean, he earned his pay, I think. If I'm right that he was a staffer, and I believe he was, because he took Biden from, you know, way out of viability up to the baseline viability by just really working all the other groups and getting people over. But it was a slog. And I really want to emphasize, Biden had a very, very bad night last night.
Yeah, he did. He did.
We don't know how bad, but you know, once we get all the numbers, we'll have a clarity on it. But I can guarantee you.
So this is a bump. Let me just say something. Coming from New Hampshire, this is a bump for Mayor Pete. And the reason it's a bump, this is a bump for Mayor Pete in New Hampshire especially. So let me tell you what I've written down. I've written down that, I know everyone keeps saying, oh, I wish I could sort of take a piece of all the candidates and put them together. Well, guess what? Of all the candidates, John, the person who at least puts the moderate wing together and the only one is Mayor Pete. So here's what I wrote down. I wrote down he's a young Joe. I wrote down he's a mayor with the same kind of black constituency issues as Bloomberg. He's from the Midwest. He's the change agent. He's gay and he's young. He's moderate politically. He has no D.C. history. He has no record. He has a military record. He's articulate and passionate. And guess what? He knows how to weave faith into who he is and why he's running. When you and Wall Street likes him, and he like and big donors like him. So you look at all these things, and you tell me one moderate running. I mean, he's like Amy Klobuchar with personality. You know, I mean, you can't say that she's the only one from the Midwest. You know, and you've got all these things, and I'm looking at this, and to a large extent, you know, Bloomberg and Mayor Pete right now, I think, were the two that benefited from last night more than anyone else.
I think you're basically right about that. One thing about Mayor Pete, though, I think there's going to be a bit of blowback on his victory claim. You know, he gave a very carefully scripted, very, you know, he used all kinds of terms that translated in, you know, whatever, you know, clips you have from his speech as him declaring victory. We're going to go victorious to New Hampshire.
Right. But that's Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton did exactly that in New Hampshire. He was the comeback kid. He ranked second. Paul Tsongas won, but nobody even remembers Paul Tsongas' name. They only remember Bill Clinton. He's pulling a page out of the Clinton book. You know that.
He totally is pulling a page out of it. I'm just telling you, you're right that there's all these things that you mentioned, but there's also a deep, deep skepticism about him on the part of a lot of folks as well. And I think he played a little bit too much into his skepticism. I think last night, I know what he was trying to do. I understand. He was actually desperately trying to register a victory for fundraising purposes, to be quite honest, because he needs a lot of money to come in fast.
Right.
But compare that with what Elizabeth Warren Bernie Sanders did. They did their standard speeches and that, but they did it with much more dignity. And I haven't heard anybody say it yet, but if somebody slaps the right term, you know, the where's the beef kind of term on Buttigieg as regards that speech, or the, you know, I won't exploit his youth and inexperience. You remember all of our...
Yeah, exactly. You know, that was funny.
I knew JFK.
Yeah, exactly,
right?
Exactly. So let me just say something.
I don't
something.
Know what the line would be, but if they slap that one on him as a result of this, he could get hurt.
Okay, so John, I love you, but let me tell you why I'm going to disabuse you of that statement.
Sure.
And that is that Mayor Pete was not running against Bernie and Warren. Bernie and Warren were running against Bernie and Warren. He was running about expectations about Joe Biden, and probably even to some extent maybe expectations about punching above her weight with Amy Klobuchar. Mm-hmm. So given that, he was not claiming a win against Bernie and Warren. He was claiming a win, as I pointed out, he's a young Joe Biden. And what he basically solidified, I think, last night, and we'll find out whenever the numbers come in, and I hope in my lifetime, that he was successful. And you and I both know, if you were watching CNN or MSNBC and they were at a bunch of different caucus sites around the state, you did get to see that when Amy couldn't get her numbers, or when Joe couldn't get their numbers, or Yang couldn't get their numbers, to a large extent, Mayor Pete benefited from that. So as, you know, Elizabeth Warren is everyone's second choice, yet we saw with Mayor Pete is that he was everyone's second choice as well. So those two candidates, I think, in an interesting way, you know, have an opportunity here, because I think maybe some of the top of the ticket is a little bit damaged. You know, did Bernie come out with the numbers he wanted? I don't know. Did Joe come out with the numbers he wanted? I don't know. But what I think you see is that there's a greater sort of conversation for a Warren and a greater conversation for a Mayor Pete if you're looking at the moderate wing and the progressive wing.
Well, I'll give you that. That's an interesting thing. Although I don't think Warren necessarily stakes as much of a claim.
No, I think Mayor Pete does more. Yes,
the progressive wing, as you might imagine. My read is that Warren, you know, I'll tell you, you know how Warren moved up in the caucus I was at?
Oh.
Klobuchar people. She got a decent chunk of Klobuchar people over. There was not, this ideological thing didn't play quite as hard as I thought it might. And the one other thing was the way that the Sanders people at the caucus I was at prevailed. It was they were the most successful.
Yeah.
The way they went kind of over the line, really into the big numbers, was they got a very substantial portion of the Yang folks.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it was actually, you saw a rare bit of drama at the caucus I was at, because the caucus chair, who was very good, very effective, said at a certain point to the Yang folks, you know, who were there in big numbers, they did quite well, but he said to them, you're not going to make viability. This is the point you have to make a choice.
Right.
And one guy raised his sign up and started walking over to the Sanders folks, and I would say about, you know, 10, 12 people followed him.
Yeah, it's,
and,
not,
you know,
it's not
it was
surprising.
So I'm just saying that I think there's much more of a complexity here, and this is what's interesting. In New Hampshire, those Yang people aren't going to walk over.
No, they're going to stick with you. And they are so they will stick. I need to let you go. You're coming to New Hampshire. I can't wait to see you. Let's
can't
hang
wait
out.
To see you.
All right.
All
take
right.
care, John Nichols. All right,
take
Joe. Bye bye. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, the day after the Iowa caucus with no decision. All right, everyone, we're trying to figure out what's going on with our labor news and our climate connections. As soon as we get to figure out what's happening with our computer, because, of course, once again, like the Iowa caucus, we are being challenged by change and technology. You know, I think this is very apocryphal. I think the fact that this is happening now, and it's never, ever happened before, almost makes me feel like there is something in the air. There is something in the air.
And maybe Andrew Yang is correct. Machinery and technology are something we have to worry about.
Exactly. So, everyone, we're going to be talking in our next segment with two reporters from Kaiser Health News. Obviously, we're going to be talking about the coronavirus. I mentioned to the two women that we're going to be joined by a little bit about one of the reasons why. Obviously, I was reaching out because there's a concern internationally. Is this a pandemic or just really just basically contained within Asia? And at this point, it looks like China still is the sort of epicenter of this disease. But more importantly, because my daughter is living in Shanghai, and all the misinformation and all the fear.
I went to the doctor, and the doctor said, son,
I hear something playing.
And I'm 71. You're falling apart. You're not living right. I went to the doctor, and the doctor said loud, you got to stop hanging out with that old in crowd. Living's a battle, and you're losing the fight. I went to the doctor, and the doctor said, boy, your body is a temple. It's not a toy. Fill up this here paper cup and give it to the nurse. Don't spill it now. I went to the doctor. Doctor said, friend, this should be the middle, but it could be the end. You better get better, else you're gonna get worse. Oh, I went to the doctor. Oh, I went to the doctor. I went to the doctor, and the doctor said, sir, we got back the x-ray. Everything's a blur. It's all positive, that's what every single test shows. I went to the doctor. Doctor said, kid.
All right, everyone. So we have a little bit of craziness with our technology right now. But more importantly than that, we have our guests. And that's really what makes the reason for this show. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. It is the day after the New Hampshire. It's the day after the Iowa caucus. God, I am totally confused here. It is the day after the Iowa caucus. We still have no results in that caucus. And it is scary on a lot of levels. It is just really scary about what happened last night. But what is, to my extent, equally frightening is the whole question of what's happening in China with the coronavirus. And as many of you know, as I just mentioned before, my daughter lives in Shanghai. I'm hearing from her every day and getting the updates from what she knows, which is actually limited knowledge, as she gets locked into her compound in Shanghai. So I saw a series of articles that were written at Kaiser Health News, and I thought, you know what? This is where you need to go. These are the people that you trust. We have joining us right now Anna Maria Barry, Jester. She is a senior correspondent with Kaiser Health News. She focuses on public health and health disparities. We have Anna Elmendraria. I'm sure I did it wrong. I apologize. She covers the business of healthcare and healthcare policy. She was born in Manila, Philippines, and grew up in Wellington, New Zealand. And before moving to California, she worked at HuffPost for 9 years. Let me welcome Anna M and Anna A. All right, Anna Marie, thank you so much for joining us. And Anna, pronounce your last name so I don't butcher it anymore on the air.
It was very, very close. Thank you so much. It's Anna Almendrala, and thank you so much for having us.
Well, it is a pleasure. So I posted the two articles that both of you had written. But before I did that, you also had a post at Kaiser Health News, which I thought was actually very useful. And it was, will coronavirus snowball into a pandemic? Some optimistic that it could be avoided. Others aren't so sure. And I felt like as they were giving us these little chunks of news, Anna Maria, I felt like I was like, oh, my God, once again, I need a Ouija board. What are they predicting? What are they telling me? And really, at this point, at least tell me, what do we know? And have we moved to a place where you really could call it a pandemic, given my understanding of a definition of pandemic? Not yet.
That's correct. Yeah, there's so much going on here, and it's all moving very quickly. There's a couple things that are really important. One is that we know so much more at this stage in this outbreak than we have in previous outbreaks. So in a sense, we're getting a ton of information very quickly. On the other hand, there's still a lot more questions than answers. So there's still a ton we don't know about, you know, sort of how infectious this virus is, how deadly it is, how many people are actually infected. But that said, there's more than 20,000 confirmed cases right now. The vast majority of them are in China. There's been 427 deaths. All but two of those are in mainland China. It is not yet a pandemic, but there is concern that that could happen. And there's a lot of questions about whether or not it can be contained, as happened with SARS, and eventually the virus more or less died off, or whether or not it's going to become, you know, a virus that sort of regularly rotates and pops up, you know, every flu season or throughout the year, as is the case with four other coronaviruses that we currently have and make up what's believed to be something like, you know, a quarter of colds in the United States.
So let me just make sure that I have the definition right. I'm correct here that a pandemic is a disease with significant outbreaks in multiple regions or continents. And the reason why this is not defined as a pandemic is that basically it is the focus of China right now, and that the deaths and the spread really is happening within the confines of China. Is that correct, Anna?
That's right. And the important thing here is that all, you know, the rest of the world is on high alert and is trying to make sure that they contain the virus and keep it from spreading elsewhere. But the vast majority of cases and the most of the spread right now really is in mainland China.
So I talked to my daughter this morning, Anna, and one of the things that she said to me was, I mean, obviously there's a lot of information swirling around. There's the country's in basic sort of a quasi shutdown. Factories, no one's showing up for work at factories. People are being, you know, examined before they come back to Shanghai because they've been on vacation because of the Chinese New Year. So she said it happened at such a crazy time because everybody is everywhere and everybody wants to come home. You know, it's like because they've all been traveling. So I guess I need to know a little bit about the fact that we know more, Anna Marie, you said, that we've known in the past. Is that because China is so terrified that they're willing to be more open and transparent than they normally are, number one? And number two, if we know more, who's dying from this? Is this really an old person and child, like, you know, young babies that are dying? Or is this really something where the mortality is across the board when you're looking at sort of the age range?
So we don't really know yet what the mortality looks like, partly because you have to wait till people have sort of the virus has run its course. So, you know, some people who have it right now will get sicker. Some people will get better. And until the outbreak is over, you kind of don't have that information, which is a challenge in these situations. That said, from the report so far, it is predominantly affecting older people, and specifically men seem to be more prone to the virus than women.
Wow.
So, yes, it is. It does seem that the serious cases are concentrated among people who have already compromised immune systems in some way, and or are elderly, and again, are men. The question about information and it moving faster, I mean, part of that is just that the world has changed and we are ever more connected.
Right.
There is you know, I can't really speak to what's happening in China and information, and there are all kinds of reports coming out about, you know, the Chinese government being very open about things, other reports saying that they have been hiding some information. I can't speak to that, but I do think that it's important. The WHO has been commending China for being much more open than they had in the past in previous outbreaks.
Okay, Anna A. So let me ask another question. So I remember landing in Shanghai in 2013. And when I got to Shanghai, what was so amazing to me was that they wouldn't let the plane land in 2013 because it was the worst pollution they'd ever had. And there was an inversion in Shanghai. So we actually were diverted to Beijing, which is usually more polluted than Shanghai. And then I finally got back to Shanghai. Here's what I noticed. Everybody, let me tell you about it. Everybody's wearing masks. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like I would wear a hat, they would wear a mask. My daughter, when I went to her apartment in Shanghai, she had different kinds of masks depending on the level of pollution. So I am seeing all of China putting on a mask. I believe you wrote a piece about the fact that there's a significant Chinese population in places like California. And as soon as they heard about the coronavirus, they did what is, you know, culturally normal for them. They put on masks. Well, I know about how I look at masks in the United States, and I'm like, wow, what's wrong with you? Where in China, what's wrong with you is if you don't have a mask on. So talk to me a little bit about the mask conversation, because the Vatican just sent masks to China. My daughter's looking at her masks. You know, people are putting them on. What is it about China and masks that I need to understand from a cultural perspective, but the masks actually do anything other than to say, I'm afraid?
You're absolutely right, Arnie. In many different Asian countries, face masks are a normal sight. They're part of a daily personal hygiene routine that isn't necessarily just about illness.
Yeah.
As you said, it's also about air pollution, smog, let's say like volcano ash in the Philippines. And it's such an entrenched part of the culture that there are some masks that are, you know, for fashion. There are masks that people wear to match the rest of their outfit, in addition to the paper surgical masks that we're seeing out and about now.
Right.
For people who wear masks in public before the coronavirus outbreak, you know, there was there's sort of a dual meaning, right? It could either be saying, I don't want to be sick, like I'm traveling right now. I know that I'm going to be boxed in with a lot of different people. I don't want to get an illness. Or it could say, I have a little cough. I am sneezing. I want to protect other people around me. So in that sense, we don't actually know what a face mask means if you're just looking at someone without talking to them.
There was a quote in, I believe it was in your piece, Anna A., and the quote was this: fear at this moment is the greatest epidemic that we have. And the reason I even mention this is that in the United States, you're not allowed in some places to cover your face. That you can't go to school and cover your face. You know, the whole idea of transparency, you know, the clear backpacks. You can't cover your face. So how is the community in California and in the Chinese community, how are we weaving both their cultural natural tendency to do this, the idea that people are now embracing masks as if it's a solution? And I think you put it out in your piece, actually the best thing to do is not to put on a mask, but wash your damn hands.
That's right. The CDC right now is telling people to just practice standard hygiene, washing hands frequently for a long time with lots of soap, covering your cough and your sneeze with your elbow or with a tissue. But I think a really interesting place that this cultural disconnect is playing out is in the school districts. So right now in Southern California, there are many different school districts that have high concentrations of Asian and Chinese American students. And each school district is being left to their own devices to decide whether or not they're going to have a policy on masks. In one of my stories, the Alhambra School District, which has a lot of Chinese Americans, they're sort of taking a hard line against it. They're saying, this is fear-mongering. We should leave the mask supply for the hospitals. Please do not come to school with a mask. But in other school districts with a high population of Chinese students, they're saying, you know, we agree with the CDC and the Department of Health that masks don't really help, but if it makes you feel better, if it's something that you want to do for your cultural practice, go ahead, come to school with the mask on.
All right. So, Anna Marie, I want to talk to you about your piece of Kaiser Health News. Public health officials offer scant details on U.S. coronavirus patients. So not only do I want to know about the handful of patients that have it, Boston has it. I know there's a number of locations around the country. I think even New Hampshire may have a coronavirus individual who's been identified. He came from Wuhan province. So there's a couple of things. How prepared is the United States? Numero uno. Tell me about my public health approach to anything in the United States. My understanding is that we've been draining the public health system for decades, and that Donald Trump actually dismantled the organization within his administration that would be looking at these sort of potential global pandemics. I'm kind of curious as how prepared are we and how quickly can we go from unprepared or draining resources to turning on the switch and knowing what to do and having a network of people around the country that we can trust that will inform us.
Yeah, in many ways, we are very prepared. We have hospitals that are well-equipped, and we have a whole system of communication between the CDC and healthcare providers. We have incredible labs. You know, we have a ton of resources that are available to us when an outbreak like this hits. We do have some vulnerabilities, though. So speaking of face masks, for example, 95% of the surgical masks used in the United States are manufactured in China. And if they have an increased use there or the supply chain is disrupted, this great reporter, Maren McKenna, has been writing about how, you know, we actually are already at having, some places are saying they're having trouble acquiring a sufficient supply of masks, some healthcare providers. So there are vulnerabilities. That said, we really do have very high quality care, and we are quite prepared for this kind of outbreak. And they have been preparing for a long time. But as you said, it's true that the public health system has lost a lot of funding over the years in certain ways. And you know, so it's something you have to be vigilant about. That's always the trick here, is that it's easy to care when we're in the midst of an outbreak. It's a lot harder to pull in the funds when you haven't had one for a while.
Exactly. But as I'm thinking about this, you mentioned the fact that we're also running out of face masks because China is one of the biggest producers of face masks on the planet. But the other thing that we also know about China is that China actually is connected to our drug materials. And that I believe I saw a statistic like 80% of some of the content in the drugs that we use here in part comes from China. And as I mentioned to you before, we're seeing the shutdown of everything. That includes factories that make drugs. It talks about the transportation system that would move product to market. All those things are grinding to a halt. And it turns out you don't need a tariff war to talk about China. We know that whether you are going into Walmart and looking at everything made in China, but now I can deal with, you know, I'm not getting a plastic cup. What I can't deal with, however, is if I don't have access to the drug I need or some of the ingredients in that drug. What does that say about also our security system, Anna A., about what we need to diversify? I mean, it's good that China does it cheap. It's good that Big Pharma, you know, exported all their jobs to China. But now we're looking at a place where our level of vulnerability is now heightened because guess what? That very important place, that huge part of the planet now is so compromised because it is with an epidemic, not a pandemic, but an epidemic, and that will impact all of us, including from a health perspective.
That's right. It's not just the pharmaceuticals. It's like the primary materials that make them are often, the vast majority come from China. So there's medical devices, there's a wide range of products that we, you know, are sort of necessary to our healthcare system that come from China. And there has been a lot of concern from people who write about health security, biosecurity, these kinds of things, that this sort of singular supply chain is going to pose a problem. And that could be for political reasons, but it also, as we're seeing right now, could be because there's an overburdened system in another country that interrupts our supply chains. And that is causing a lot, that is of great concern to a lot of people.
And it should be a great concern. The other thing that I guess I want to talk about is that, you know, how do we develop the level of trust we're going to need dealing with this? Right now, it is not an issue in the United States, but the issue of trust is huge in this country right now. I mean, I was kidding the other day that we should take the Sharpies away from President Trump because, God forbid, he uses a Sharpie when we're talking about the coronavirus. But what I'm trying to figure out is that how do we approach this in a rational way? Do we have to learn about symptoms? Do we need to? I mean, you don't want to shun certain people because we know it's in Asia, and then once again, what does that do to stigmatize Asians? You know, I am concerned about our behavioral response, even if the pandemic doesn't get here, because to some extent, I feel like it sort of massages the lack of trust and the divide between us. So I guess I'm gonna talk to you, Anna Marie. What is it that people are recommending, the kind of guidance as we approach this and want to do it in a way that's both methodical and rational?
Yeah, the most important thing is that we are not at great risk in the United States right now. There's all sorts of screening measures happening for people who are arriving from places with, you know, large outbreaks, mainland China specifically. There's a very intact healthcare system that's prepared to test and treat people and monitor them. And so at this point, we are not at great risk in the United States. That said, the second most important thing is that the country at large continues to be prepared for outbreaks like this. And so they are acting, you know, with vigilance. But the important thing in the U.S. is to wash your hands because it's flu season. And the flu is quite deadly.
Exactly.
And has been spreading wildly.
So Anna A., as I was asking that question, I was actually thinking of your article. And again, your article, Masks Reveal Cultural Disconnect as LA's Chinese Community Braces for Coronavirus. And just as this is happening, we saw the reinstatement of a very vigorous public charge rule when it comes to legal immigrants. Let me repeat this, not undocumented, but legal immigrants. And it is now making a lot of legal immigrants very fearful about accessing this remarkable healthcare system that Anna Marie, you were just describing before. You know, we have doctors connected, but now a lot of people who are in the immigrant community, and I'm thinking of the Chinatowns of this world, okay? So not only are they putting on the masks, which kind of explain their fear as well as their cultural identity, but now they've been discouraged from accessing things like Medicaid, accessing the kind of public services they may need if they think they are sick. So have you started connecting this public charge rule with what it could mean if we have to address this in a more effective manner?
You know what, Arnie? That's a really great idea for an investigation that Kaiser Health News should do.
I did
visit the Chinatown Service Center, which primarily serves Chinese American immigrants or Chinese immigrants, and they're primarily a Medi-Cal population. From what I can tell from talking to the doctors and the CEO, people are still coming in. People are not afraid to access their services because they also have tax preparation. They have dentists. They have behavioral health centers. That said, I think that this is such a fast-moving situation that it would be good to track these trends over time. And as to your point about the sort of racial suspicion about Asian people, Chinese people wearing face masks, there have been reports on social media of people shunning Chinese people in subways, in public transportation, kids teasing Asian-looking kids about their face mask or not wanting to play with them or wanting to test them for coronavirus. So I think that this is concerning. The CDC is doing a great job of messaging with almost every press conference. We do not want to treat people from certain countries or even people with certain travel histories different from other people. We have to work as a nation to not stigmatize these populations. That said, you know, people who look Asian are reporting that they're experiencing everything from like weird looks to outright rejection.
Oh, God. Oh, hold on. Yes. I'm sorry, Ken. Go on.
They aren't necessarily coming from somewhere else.
They're born here.
They could have been born here. There could be two generations living in California,
well,
right?
Exactly. So, Anna Marie, before I let you guys go, right now, how are they treating people who have gotten the coronavirus? What is the treatment for them? I know that this is a virus. Therefore, you can't necessarily give them a drug. It doesn't work that way. It doesn't work with viruses. So how are people being treated? I know they've been building hospitals at the rate of like one hospital every 6 days in China, which is unbelievable. But at the same time, I'm just trying to figure out what is being recommended in order to get people from illness to health.
So a lot of people are experiencing very mild illness, and the treatment is fairly minor. Several of the people in the United States who've gotten ill have been hospitalized or are in their homes and sort of isolated, but they aren't actually experiencing very strong symptoms. Other people, there's a lot of drug development going on. I mean, as we were talking about earlier, this is moving very quickly, and so the treatments are sort of being tested as we go. There's been some success with some antiviral treatments that have been given out.
Okay.
There's testing of some new antivirals that are hadn't yet been approved by the FDA that they're trying to give to some patients to see if they work. So there's a lot to learn there, but it's generally being treated like other viruses, as you said.
So as we're going forward on this and we're beginning to sort of understand it, I know that China has been somewhat reluctant always to sort of share information and share news. Have they allowed the CDC, have they allowed the American sort of health community into China in order to assist them? It's not that we have an incredible special level of expertise, but to some extent we actually do. And I think in a bizarre way, sometimes things like global warming, sometimes things like epidemics or pandemics, while they're negative, they're also potentially a positive because it can actually bring us together to figure out how do we save each other. So how have the Chinese been, Anna A., in allowing the U.S. Scientists and health community to assist them in order to not only help them in China, but to also bring back that knowledge here?
Well, I actually think that I read this morning that China is allowing U.S. health experts to come in. I'm not sure if that's happened yet or whether China has just announced that it's happening. But, yes, this is a story that's in Reuters this morning.
Well, and the other thing is, Anna Maria, is that I also read that Facebook and a number of other places are beginning to clearly monitor the misinformation and the fear that's being spread on Facebook. And they're trying to basically eliminate that so that the sort of the bad news that turns out to be inaccurate is not being shared with everyone. And if you could recommend, Anna Marie, a place or a site, is it Kaiser Health News that we go to? Is there a place where you can get accurate information in a timely fashion about what is happening both in China as well in the United States, what to look for, what's real and what's Memorex here? Because if nothing else, I mentioned before that the term trust is something in short supply. And when now you're dealing with something like this, I want to make sure that I don't pass on bad information. I want to make sure that whatever I share is accurate.
You're right that there is a ton of disinformation around this outbreak, as there always are. And social media is a very tricky place to try and get reputable information. I certainly think Kaiser Health News is a reputable source. There are lots of other publications as well with great reporters. Stat News has been doing a great job of staying on top of the day-to-day. The WHO also releases daily situation reports that can give you accurate numbers and information about the population most affected. There's lots of good stuff there, and they're quite readable even for a general audience. So I think the CDC also is filled with information both on how to protect yourself and also what is known and what the risks are in the United States right now.
So the reason I say this is that I want to end with kind of the idea of the bad information that gets shared, and I think I may have shared some of this with you, but this was from my daughter from the other day. Edwin and his parents and I are fine. And then she goes on to say, I'm grateful for all I'm learning at this time. I just pray that the people in Wuhan are okay. Now, this is to tell you how crazy it is in China, which is also being threaded with misinformation. It is the most horrifying for them, I'm sure. Edwin was having bad dreams last night because some people are dying in Wuhan, possibly not being reported, and because everyone is so afraid that they're leaving the bodies in the street. Listen to this. I'm not sure how true this is, but Edwin is very sad and scared. He's also upset because there's a huge rumor going around that America did this. He's worried about my safety. They're saying that the American government did this to hurt China. There are just so many unknowns. Listen to this, everyone. There's so many unknowns swimming around us at the moment that it's what makes this so challenging. So as we were talking about what's happening to Chinese folks here and that people are being, you know, harassed now, understand the opposite is happening in China because now this is part of the rumor mill and now are Americans vulnerable. That's where information is so important. And we need to find places we can trust. Thank you so much, Anna 1 and Anna 2, for joining us from Kaiser Health News. I have a feeling we'll be calling you back. I really value your knowledge and your calmness.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. All right, everyone. Can we end? Was the music work? Can we try it again?
I'm hoping we're going to end with the Iowa Corn Song.
All right, here we go.